Welcome to Get Connected, KDNK's monthly public affairs show about the people and organizations that make up the giving and service community from Aspen to Parachute. I'm Amy Barr, your host, and I serve as the executive director of United Way Battlement to the Bells. And this program is my opportunity to share my insights and connections with local nonprofits. Each month, I interview different charities, hear from dedicated volunteers, talk to the donors that support charitable work, and tell you about ways you can volunteer. This month's show features local chaplain Sean Jung, and we'll discuss the challenging subjects of death and dying. And as always, we'll offer up-to-the-minute announcements about volunteer opportunities and nonprofit events and charitable needs in our area. Sean, you've been deeply involved as a chaplain, first for our local home care and hospice of the Valley, and now at Valley View Hospital. I know you also perform a lot of wedding ceremonies, memorial services. I've probably attended both. And that's among your other community work. So tell us first, what is a chaplain? How are chaplains trained? What are some general duties that chaplains like yourself handle? And before I met you, I only thought of chaplains as ministering in the armed forces.
I think a lot of people probably have that conception of chaplaincy. One of the challenges I've had in being a chaplain with hospice and in being a chaplain at the hospital is that if it's presented to a patient or a family, would you like to see the chaplain? Many people right away see a white collar and a cross and a Bible, and they will. We almost all have a history with religion somewhere in our lives, and sometimes it's not great. Chaplaincy isn't about religion. Chaplaincy is about a ministry of presence. There's a component to chaplaincy that there is a connection to something you can't see or touch that's at work in our lives. And so many people today will say, well, I'm very spiritual, but I'm not religious, so I don't want the chaplain. Well, I'm perfect for that person. I'm very spiritual, and I'm not terribly religious. It took me a long time to even be completely comfortable with using the word God, because so many people have had that shoved down their throats and have been hurt in the name of God. Wars are waged in the name of God and in religion. So that's one of the biggest challenges to overcome, is that chaplaincy is about spirit, and it's about presence, and it's about no attachment to outcome, no agenda. You're not there to try to sell anybody anything. You're not trying to convince them to think the way you do. I just want to find out, what role has spirituality or religion played in your life?
So in the hospital, when someone says, do you want to see a chaplain, does the patient ever say, gosh, it must be really bad?
Sometimes. There's four of us at the hospital, and Lauren Martin is the director of the spiritual care team, and then there's three of us on his team. So we do rotate being on call, and we do rotate doing rounds upstairs on the fourth floor and going in to visit patients. And you might walk into someone's room and just introduce yourself, and they might have that reaction. Oh, gosh, it must be really bad if they've sent the chaplain in. Or if you come to the emergency room because you've been called, there's been an accident or some sort of traumatic event, and they will call the chaplains to just be on standby, both for the staff and for the families and for the patients or the victims of accidents. And if you walk into a family room and introduce yourself as the chaplain, you can see that look on their face that the news is bad. Not always. They just want to make sure that everybody's there that can be helpful.
I'm curious about this because I've never had a chaplain come in a hospital room. I think I was in the hospital once. Do you also work perhaps with the patient's own minister or priest or rabbi at any time?
Not usually work with them, but I always want to try to find out if somebody has a connection to a particular faith, even if they don't practice here in the Valley. If they were raised Methodist or they go to the Methodist church, I always want to offer to get the Methodist minister there. And sometimes they want that. Many Catholics want to have a priest, and they just want whichever one can get there quickest. They want a priest. It's important to them. But working with them once we've brought them in, no, I step away. If they have a connection and they have a person, we want to make sure that person shows up if the patient wants it.
Well, and going back just a second, because I think I knew you when you were in the middle of your chaplaincy studies. What's entailed for a chaplain? I mean, gee, there are four, including you at Valley View Hospital. That's quite a few.
It is. And it was an interesting process. I went through a four-year program that's like the slow train because I was working full-time.
Uh-huh.
You can do a unit. It's called a unit. And if you have four units of chaplaincy, then you can sit for what they call your certification. So you need four units to sit for certification. And I wanted to be a board certified chaplain. So it took me a year to get each unit because I would just go once a month to Grand Junction. The first year we did it in Glenwood, and I joined a group of people that were all in their fourth year. So at the end of that year, I was the only one still needing to do units, so I went to Grand Junction and studied there. And it was wonderful. What it entails basically is you need to be doing the work of chaplaincy, being overseen by someone who's already certified. So Patty Harris was the chaplain at the hospital at the time. She was the one that asked me to come and talked to her one day and said, I want you to look at this program. Just go online and check it out. I think you'd be really good at it. I think you'd love it. And I said, Patty, I'm not religious. And she said, just look at the program. I think you'd be perfect for it. And it has been such a beautiful fit in my work that I was already doing in end of life and being with staff members that were working with people at end of life. This has been an amazing progression in that.
You've seen a lot of people's life experiences, the trials, the tribulations, and birth to death life experiences, I'm sure, like many ministers and chaplains. Can you give us some idea of how such events have affected you and what you've learned through these critical experiences?
I can tell you that I know my life is infinitely richer and more meaningful to me now than ever before because of the work I've done as a chaplain. Primarily because of the work I've done at end of life. I think that the years that I spent teaching at the Montessori preschool, I didn't realize until I started studying for my chaplaincy certification just what I was seeing at work. When I loved what I did and I was good at it.
For preschoolers,
right? Well, I was with the toddlers, so with the little ones. And when I started studying for chaplaincy, I realized that what I'd been watching for 14 years was spirit at work. And I didn't realize it then. I didn't quite understand it, but that's why it was so beautiful. That's why I was so moved by it. That's why I was so enthralled with who they are, because they are so much closer to God at one and one and a half than we are at 50 or 60 or 70.
We lose it.
We become more human, and they were still more spiritual. So once I started to study, I realized that that's what I'd been watching and that that was all part of coming to this place that I am now, which I hope is not anywhere near where I'll finish.
Well, and so really you were involved at Home Care and Hospice of the Valley. Was that your first chaplaincy assignment?
No, I started when it was Roaring Fork Hospice, and it was part of Valley View Hospital.
I see.
And then I can't remember dates, but that was a six-year stint, and I started as the volunteer coordinator and then started studying for my chaplaincy and following Patty around, and she turned me loose and let me do that. And then when that hospice closed and the new hospice rose from those ashes, I was the first person Marky Butler hired as her chaplain and her volunteer coordinator and everything else, because it was just me and Marky.
Sure.
And so she gave me really my start and trusted that I knew what I was doing, because I didn't actually get my certification for another 2 years after that.
What were your experiences at Home Care and Hospice of the Valley? Because I'm sure it can be very stressful mentally and emotionally.
Well, one of the things I learned, and this I can tie this in again to my work in Montessori, I hadn't been with Mark and Catherine Ross long in the toddler room. When I went to Mark and said, we need to do parenting classes here because these little guys are coming into the toddler program with baggage, emotional baggage.
At that age?
Yes, they're 18 months old. We need to back up and help parents understand how we see their children and what we've learned by studying Montessori pedagogy and how she saw children. And so we started doing that. And I got a certification in some parenting class that I was doing. So then in hospice, the grief that comes at the moment of diagnosis, let alone at the moment of death, people are grieving all the way through that. And the staff is grieving. The staff is grieving losses. So it wasn't long at all before I became very interested in wanting to study grief. What I knew was that I was in this certification program for chaplaincy. So I made an agreement with Greg that I wouldn't, and myself.
Greg, your husband.
My husband, that I wouldn't pursue another program until I was done with this one. So when I got my certification, the very next year I studied with Alan Wolfelt over in Fort Collins and studied a grief certification program for grief counseling. And he was just somebody that I had followed through his writings and respected greatly and learned so much from about grief and facilitating groups and doing support groups and all that kind of stuff. So that has been something that opened up to me as a result of my work with home care.
So here's the deal. This is kind of a two-part interview because you've been doing so much work lately, and we want to come back in the second half to talk about what you've been doing, really, I guess I could say, from battlement to the bells, from aspen to parachute. And let's talk a little bit about that program because there's a lot of chatter going on in the KDNK area based on the workshops that you, I guess I could say, co-produce. So we're going to be right back after our announcements. You're listening to Get Connected. Up next, Robin Tolan of USON. Robin will offer a selection of the latest community volunteer opportunities and nonprofit events posted on our Get Connected pages at unitedwaybb.org.
Welcome to Get Connected, a great way to link volunteers and donors with the organizations that need them. I'm Robin Tolan, Director of Development for YouthZone and a partner, nonprofit organization, and grant recipient of United Way Battlement to the Bells. If you're looking for a great opportunity to volunteer and want a project that fits your interests, you can go to unitedwaybb.org and sign up on the Get Connected free link. There's an easy way for you to align your interest with volunteer opportunities and fill out the forms right there. There's also the possibility that whatever you sign up for, you will be contacted immediately by the organization that you sign up for. And while we're talking about the variety of opportunities to volunteer, we need you to ring the bell. You can ring the bell from any place, from Battlement Mesa all the way to El Jebel. The Rotary Club of Carbondale and many other the Rotary Clubs are currently ringing the bell. You can ask them if you can join in the fun, or again, you can sign up on the UnitedWayBB.org website. We're already on our way to longer days. Well, officially, that will be December 21st. But just think of all the fun events that are coming up this winter. We're going to celebrate the beginning of the solstice on Saturday, December 17th, starting at 7 p.m. at the 3rd Street Center in Carbondale. This event will include a costume pageant of the story of the goddess Demeter and her daughter Persephone, plus Hades, the god of the underworld, and his three-headed dog, followed by an outdoor roaring bonfire and winter warm-up treats. The snow has fallen, finally, and Sunlight Mountain Resort, who is celebrating its 50th year, is gearing up to present the 32nd annual Skier Appreciation Day, scheduled for Friday, January 6th, a signature fundraiser for the United Way Battlement to the Bells, and also will include a celebration of Sunlight's 50th anniversary. People are dressed up in costume. There are prizes for best costume. There's also several different skis that are given away, snowboards, and many other offerings from local merchants. To sign up for these volunteer opportunities and upcoming nonprofit events, you just visit UnitedWay.org bb.org. Also, if you are a nonprofit and have a event coming up, please get it on the United Way bb.org's website immediately. We want to share all of these events with our listeners. Thank you.
Thanks, Robin. Welcome back to the second segment of our two-part interview with local chaplain Sean Jung, who recently co-hosted community conversations around the often difficult subjects of death and dying and helping those left behind to carry out your last wishes. You and I have talked about death and dying and grief counseling each time we see each other, sort of. We kind of run
it. We do. It just runs right to it.
So, in fact, you and Nurse Barbara Bush have recently done quite a few workshops in the KDNK listening area, and you've offered this on various grief and death and planning for death, different sessions. I was surprised. I attended one, and you both said, gee, we thought about 15 people would show up, and I think there were 50, and it was standing room only. So
yeah, it was astounding.
Well, so then you expanded. So talk a little bit about that and about Barbara and your how you came together as well.
Barbara and I met when we were working with Home Care and Hospice of the Valley. She was a hospice nurse, but she's been in the Valley so many decades, I don't even know. And she's done so many things in healthcare, emergency care, hospital care, hospice care. She is no longer working with hospice right now. Currently, she's working in the emergency room at Grand River Hospital in Rifle. But we both share this passion for trying to help people befriend the fact that we're going to die and getting friendlier with having the conversation with your family. Because what we both witnessed over and over and over again in our work with hospice is that people die unprepared. The person doing the dying is unprepared. The family is unprepared, not just in the emotional sense, but in the business end of it. Nobody wants to look at it. Nobody wants to talk about it. Partly, I mean, there's so many reasons. One is the grief. We don't know what to do with grief. We are the most grief-avoidant culture on the planet because we don't know how to do it. We don't know how to mourn. We aren't taught by our family of origin how to do it well. And so we want to avoid talking about anything that might be connected to it. So Barb and I were just having a cup of coffee one day at the hospital. She came to see me and she said, let's just put it out there to the community. Let's put a little ad in the paper that says Sean Jung and Barb Bush are going to be at the loft having a cup of coffee at 3 o'clock on this date. And we looked through our calendars and we just almost, you know, threw a dart at a date and picked it. And that's the one that you came to that you're talking about that was standing room. We were blown away by the outpouring of interest. Unfortunately, as beautiful as it was that they allowed us to do it there, it is a coffee shop and it's open to the public. And it was in the summer. It was hot.
Yes.
There's overhead music. There wasn't any privacy. It was hard for people to hear. We just didn't have any idea that that many people would show up. So we subsequently booked the Carbondale Library to do one, and that one got canceled at the last minute. But we recently did one at the Glenwood Library that was also very well attended. It tells us that people are hungry to get friendlier with talking about death and that more of us are getting closer to it. Every day we don't die, we're a day closer to dying. And so, and people are taking care of parents that are elderly and they won't talk about it. And so there's just a great interest in it. There's also a group of people up in Aspen, the Aspen Center for Social Values, which I am a fellow with.
Oh, interesting.
They do a lot of stuff at the Jewish Community Center up there. And we did a community talk on Atul Gawande's book, Being Mortal, when it first, not when it first came out, but it was over a year ago that we did it. It was hugely attended.
And what's the name of that book again?
Being Mortal.
By
Atul Gawande,
okay,
who's a physician, and his father, also a physician, was diagnosed. And so it's his story of going through that process with his father, and in that, the epiphany after epiphany that came to him about how our medical world, our medical system isn't designed and isn't taught in school how to do that, how to have advanced directive conversations with your patients, how to bring in a palliative care team when somebody has a terminal diagnosis to talk about all the options, not just all the treatment options, but the option as well of no treatment and just getting down to living what time you have left as well as you can with the help of hospice or home care or a palliative home health or a combination of the two. Let's do some treatment, but let's get palliative home health on board while we're doing it, because we know this particular treatment is going to cause some side effects that are hard to manage at home. And we want to make sure you have everything. So it's just getting comfortable with having that conversation.
Well, and, you know, I often bring up that, you know, people aren't used to people dying. In the old days, they were washed by the women. They were laid out in the home. We understood death. We, you know, buried our own, I guess, back in that generation. Our grandparents did. It's pretty sterilized these days.
It is. We have nursing homes and hospitals. And now we're removed from the death. They may die at home, but then the funeral home comes and gets them, and then they bring you back a box of ashes. Mm-hmm. Or they may do a burial with a viewing. But we are pretty removed from it. And I think that there's some beauty and some healing and some completion in relationships with people who die when we stay more connected to that whole process from the moment of death until the cremains or the remains are finalized and done.
Well, you know, this is a holiday season, so I'm sure Katie and Kay listeners are going, oh my gosh, what a downer of a discussion talking about death. But maybe we should look on this as the holiday present we give people, because I'm trying to get to the point of what you and Barbara talked about some planning documents, materials, and books that you
discussed. I mentioned advance directives a minute ago. An advance directive is not a will. It is your directive for how you want to be treated should you have a sentinel event that doesn't take your life, but you're not able to talk. It's the thing that most people don't have.
So talk about some tools that we need in order to prepare. I hope I don't die for 30 years, but what should I have in place?
Well, you should have an advance directive, which names the person that you want to have speaking for you if you can't speak. And you have had the conversation with that person so that they know what you want. Do you want a feeding tube? Do you want artificial hydration? Do you want chest compressions if you have a heart attack? If you're going to have any kind of surgery, make sure you have an advance directive. But anybody over 18 should have one. It relieves your family of having to make the really hard decisions that they don't know what you would want.
So where can you get an advance directive in order to fill out?
Your doctor's office. You can get them at any hospital. You can get them from attorneys, but you don't need an attorney. Please forgive me, all the attorneys that are listening to Katie and Kay. You do amazing work, and there is a place for you in our community, but it doesn't have to be in doing advanced care planning with people, because it's in doing their will and working with their estate, but it's not in having the conversation with their family about what their wishes are. And so people will say, well, my mom is 85 and she won't talk about this. That's okay. You get your advance directive, and there's a booklet called Your Right to Make Healthcare Decisions. Hospice and home care all have them. Hospitals, nursing homes, doctor's offices have these. There's also a very well-known document called The Five Wishes.
Oh, talk about that a little bit.
It's my favorite because it's all touchy-feely, and I'm all about touchy-feely. You make copies of these things, and then you hold on to the original. You do not lock it up. Don't put it in your safety deposit box. Don't hide it under your underwear. Put it where somebody can find it. Greg and I were in Leadville a few weeks ago, and we were walking down a residential street, and I loved what I saw. There's this little tiny house, and their DNR document, do not resuscitate document, whatever it said, I didn't walk up to it, was on their front door.
Oh my gosh.
Plastered on their front door. And so any EMT that might be called, any 911 call that's made to that house, they're going to see it. They don't have to look for it. They don't have to ask for it. The person might live alone, maybe has one of those buttons you push. If 911 is called, they'll see what the person's wishes are right there on the door.
Sean, that's what I call a planner. So let's end. Would you mention the two books and also the ones that you recommended? Maybe it is the best Christmas present we could give.
Well, I have told people before that when I did my five wishes, I made copies of it, and then I got blank ones, And I rolled them up together, my copy of my completed one with a blank one, and tied them with beautiful ribbon. And that was the gift to each one of my siblings that year. It was after both our parents had died. And so, and I told them in my card, your gift back to me is going to be to send me a copy of your completed five wishes. And so that is what you can do. You can do something like that. Make it your gift. It is such a gift to give your family to complete an advance directive. Amy, I can't tell you how many times we're with families in the hospital and nobody has anything written down and the person can't speak.
Oh, gee.
And not everybody's on the same page. Maybe sure. The family's at odds about what the person would want. It's horrific, it's agonizing, and it's unnecessary.
Sean, I have to thank you for coming in. I know it's a busy holiday time, but thank you for giving us so much of your time here at Katie and Kate.
You
and
are so welcome.
We will look for more workshops, so thank you.
Okay.
Thanks to our listeners for joining us on Get Connected and our last program of 2016. Thanks also to our guest, Valley View Hospital Chaplain Sean Jung, to Robin Tolan of Youth Zone, and also to KDNK Public Affairs Director Amy Haddon Marsh. Tune in on the first Thursday of every month at 4:30 p.m. and find our Get Connected program anytime online at kdnk.org/public-affairs.